I'm sure a few more people are going to be trickling in here as we start, but I'm thrilled that this many people have, you know, showed up on a Friday afternoon, because I particularly, you know, wanted everyone to be here for this one. It's a panel discussion. We have Sean Carroll from Caltech, who's known to very many of you. We have Karen Heyman. She is a science writer, a freelance science writer, who writes for Science Magazine, among other things, and specializes in neuroscience. We were going to have David Harris of Symmetry Magazine, but he had to cancel at the last minute, so I will be here playing devil's advocate on behalf of the editors and the mean old press. And since, you know, the devil gets to start, I'm going to basically outline a few broad aspects. The title of this session is Just Don't Quote Me, The Perils and Pitfalls of Speaking to the Press. I think all of us, including me, when you publish a book, you actually do get written about in addition to doing the writing, and you find out what it's like to be on the other side of the pen, so to speak. So we have all experienced both good and bad encounters with the press, and I think that one of the things I want to do here is talk a little bit about those experiences, what some of the frustrations are, what are some of the good things. In the end, I think we're all looking for some common ground, and kind of we want the similar thing, same thing in the end. So the discussion, I'm hoping, will have us kind of giving this give and take. I'm going to go first. We're going to have Sean talk about the topic from what it's like to be a scientist dealing with the media, some of his horror stories, some of the some of the ways that he's dealt with it. I know that I personally have heard him been interviewed for like 30 minutes in depth, going into all this intricate detail on cosmology, and they'll find the one pithy quote, and he'll come off like this total lightweight in the in the article. But there's very specific ways and strategies for working within the constraints of the press, and I think that he'll be able to shed some light on that. And then Karen will talk a little bit about those of us, because, you know, she and I are both more science writers than traditional journalists, those of us who kind of have a foot in both worlds, and we can kind of see both sides, and so we feel your pain, and yet we also kind of understand, you know, exactly what we're dealing with here. So she'll kind of do a wrap-up. If you have questions or comments, you are certainly welcome to ask them in the course of the talks, but we will have, we hope, a really lively question and answer. We're basically each going to talk for maybe 15 minutes, and then have the rest of it will basically be talking, because we want your input, we want to be able to share ideas, want to be able to hear what your experiences have been, and maybe we might have some ideas to make your future experiences better. Okay. So, pet peeves of scientists, just the ones that I hear over and over again. This is by no means exhaustive in terms of a list. Misquotation, I think, is the number one. It has happened to me. It's probably happened to every single one of you. Sometimes it's just sloppy reporting. Sometimes it's tight deadline. That's definitely, I think, one of the things that if I were going to change something about the journalist profession, I would actually ask journalists to be much more careful about how they quote people. Oversimplification, or quote-unquote dumbing down of the science. Misrepresenting the science, say by hyping results. Failing to convey subtle but important nuances, and a lot of times that is a result of space constraints, time constraints. A lot of times when I have written articles for, say, New Scientist, there's a word count, and I'm, you know, 150 words over, and they have to kind of compress the ideas, and in so doing, they conflate things, and they muddle things, and it ends up being a little less accurate than one might like. And then, of course, bad metaphors or analogies. I know that the God particle is actually, you know, a bugbear for a lot of the LHC people. You can't blame journalists for that. You can blame Leon Lederman, but on the other hand, I think that journalists just love the God particle, and I think it's here to stay. I mean, Dennis Overby had a whole piece last year in the New York Times about why he will continue to call it the God particle.
I would add failure to fact-check.
Failure to fact-check.
The New Yorker, for many years, had pieces by Jeremy Bernstein, and they were subject to the same kind of intense fact-checking.
Uh-huh.
And while it's not a journalist's practice to check the spin or direction of a story, mm-hmm. it should be their practice to check back with the sources whether they have the facts right or not.
Yes, and it frequently is, but sometimes they do in fact miss it. And I will add that to the list. We'll talk a little bit about that, because that's actually going to be one of my points.
But that's institutional, because the New Yorker is famous for having
yes.
fact fact-checkers who
aren't... They have a dedicated fact-checker.
And they aren't the editors either.
Although, so I've been called several times to have a fact-checkers, and they invariably call you 2 hours before the deadline.
Yes.
And then they go through all these facts with them, and they get some things a little wrong or they're right, but they're always pressed for time somehow.
Right.
Fact-checking has, in many places, if they do it at all, has kind of become the intern's job. And even as a reporter, I've been horrified because I'll do my own fact-checking with a source. The source will then call or email me horrified that they were called by a fact-checker who got everything wrong. Often, and it depends on the publication, there are these strange policies that I don't agree with, but there's a reason for them, which I'll get into later, that sometimes they won't read back to your exact quote. They have to paraphrase your quote, and that's where the problems could become.
Yeah. And I'm hoping one of the things that I'm going to do in the next 10 minutes is just I'm going to run through exactly what it's like to be in the reporter's shoes so that you can kind of see what the reporter does, what the editor does, where fact checkers and interns and things, and just basically how these things happen, how misquotation, how, you know, you can, one person can fact check and it'll be fine, but then someone else gets their little hands on it and ruins everything. And at that point, sometimes the reporter has no control over it. So it's a very complicated process. And one of the key questions that I want to explore is, you know, what can we work to change and what is simply the nature of the media beast? And I think there are definitely things we can work to change. And then there are things that are just kind of the nature of the beast, and we can come up with some, I think, effective strategies for working within those confines. So this is the newsroom of the London Telegraph. This is pretty much, if you're working for a major publication, this is what reporters do. They're all kind of thrown in there in this big, loud, noisy environment. There's no privacy. This is what they're doing. They're covering two or three stories a day. They're not always dedicated to writing about science. This is kind of the environment that we're talking about here. It's not quiet. It is not calm. It is very, very frenetic. There's a lot of distractions, and they're generally juggling several stories at once. So if you're wondering why it's always at the last minute, it's pretty much crisis mode 24/7. And if you're working for, say, a daily paper, magazines are very different. The New Yorker has a huge advanced lead times for their major features. They take the time to do some very, very careful fact checking. So magazines are a little better than newspapers. Newspapers are a little better than TV. There's basically a hierarchy of how good they are. And a lot of it depends on how much lead time they have. And when you're dealing with a daily newspaper, it is like zero. And this is the New York Times. I'm just showing it because they completely revamped it. This is from like the 50s, and this is their new one. And I was just talking to Dennis Overby last year, and he was complaining that basically it's like this become this futuristic, streamlined thing, and he doesn't even feel like a reporter anymore. And I also love the fact that there are no reporters in the newsroom. So it's like the news is creating itself. And some of you might not be surprised by that. Okay, so I'm going to play devil's advocate, and I'm going to go through just a few things that journalists wish that scientists understood a little bit better. And this gets back to your point, the differences between media formats and their corresponding different constraints. A daily newspaper, a TV news, a magazine, radio, even different kinds of magazines will have different needs and constraints, different deadlines, tighter schedules or looser production schedules, and they might actually have a full fact-checking department, or they might rely on some poor intern, you know, who doesn't really know what they're doing. It's a very messy kind of non-linear process in which things kind of get out there. And just to give you an example of this, Mariette DiCristina Gerosa, who is the executive editor of Scientific American, up on the AAAS website, they have a great link, which is on the next slide, on communicating science, and she's basically saying what she looks for. And it gives you an indication of how, say, Scientific American is different from a daily newspaper. And she basically says news is a commodity. Everyone's got the insta-deadline news. As soon as the research is in the journal, it's out there. And as a magazine editor with a longer production time frame, I can't print that. So Scientific American is looking for stories that aren't just the simple snapshot, but trends, analysis, observations over a longer time scale, something that we can do well that others can't. What I like about this quote is that it shows, first of all, that there are different production timelines for different publications, and also that each kind of media serves its own little niche purpose. It kind of differentiates itself. A magazine like Scientific American is not going to focus on instant reporting of news hooks. They're going to try and do a much more in-depth analysis. I think that's why a lot of scientists actually prefer writing for Scientific American or being interviewed by them. Yes?
So what is it about science that requires what you call instant headline news?
They want
what aspect of science will be reported a month from now properly as opposed to tomorrow.
It's just the nature of a 24-hour news cycle. If a paper comes out and it's a new result, the science news has to be on that. A newspaper, basically, if it's more than a few days old, it's old news. That is just how newspapers work.
Because one newspaper wants, newspaper is like the New York Times wants to print in Chicago. So once Chicago. New York Times would be interested in it.
But that would be old news. I guess what I'm trying to bring up is that most science news are not something that require immediate action, something that the public needs to be decent and aware of. Nothing would change if they learn about it now or not.
Some other newspapers are going to scoop it. The New York Post would scoop it.
Well, we could all use it all in the
you might, but your competitor would not be so discreet. That's how it is.
Yeah. And really, the problem is endemic to the profession, and I think, honestly, it probably goes back to the early history of news. You know, obviously, no one here is old enough to remember, you know, the days when you had three or four editions come out a day, although that cycle is now being repeated on the web. Oh, sorry. You didn't have to do that.
I sold the latest.
What that, and I'm thinking even earlier in time when you had the news. Well, I don't know. Maybe you were a newsboy, but you'd have the newsboys competing, and it really was this thing that, you know, if you have, you know, the Titanic sinks. Well, it would be nice to have the Titanic sinks and 1,200 people are lost in the sinking. But for a newspaper, it's good enough that our newsboy on the northeast corner is saying Titanic sinks, everybody saved, 5 minutes ahead of the kid who's saying Titanic sinks, 1,200 lost, because everybody's already spent their nickels on that paper. And unfortunately, the news business still thinks this way. Better to have it first, and we can correct it a few days later. And it's terrible. It's endemic to the profession. And if it makes you feel any better or worse, the story I was told by a senior person at a daily newspaper was that they all dread the Nobel Prize announcements because they all know they're going to have to write something in a few hours and they know they're going to get it wrong. And
I don't think anyone here disagrees with your frustration on that. I'm certainly not a big fan of news hook journalism, but it is the nature of the beast. That is a nature of the beast sort of thing.
You may be going into this later, but I wondered how the web has transformed this sense of timeline and choice of how you approach a story.
That's probably a topic for that we can maybe go into in the discussion because I think that's very important. I think I get into it a little bit towards the end when I'm talking about who decides what stories get covered and the media conglomerates that are now controlling a lot of the major media outlets. And this actually has created, I think, an appetite for, this is where blogs came in, this is where the citizen journalists and stuff, because people are so frustrated that all the news is the same. Yes.
I don't want to slow you down, so it probably should be put off to the discussion, but what was your deadline for this talk?
My deadline, what do you mean?
Well, I
wrote it last night. And then I revised it this morning.
That's all I wanted.
But these are issues that I think about and I have written about and I have talked about for years.
Oh, but...
Yeah.
That's like our...
Right, right. Yeah. And I've been, come on, I know scientists who are writing their talks while the next, while the previous speaker is still speaking. I'm not naming names, but I do know them. Mainstream media, again, does not always have the luxury of long lead times or deadline pressures, and I found this quote by Andrew Revkin of the New York Times describing what it's like to be him. He goes, look, it's continual. There are no punctuation marks. It's 24/7. That's not so important to scientists, but it does frame how we, and he says, as journalists, have to write. It adds to time pressures, and it affects the time in which you can get something wrong. What he tries to do, and I think this is a great idea, is do advanced outreach. He tries to be in touch with scientists who he knows are working on interesting problems that might have a result to report at some point, and he tries to keep lines of communication open constantly with them. This is great for a place like the New York Times that can afford a science reporter. They have a great science desk. A lot of smaller newspapers, it's just your average daily person. But
does a typical science reporter have a staff as well? Or are they
really? Oh, no, no.
In some ways, the comparison is obituaries, right? I mean, you never know when somebody's going to die, but someone out of the paper.
I can actually say that NPR actually has obituaries written in advance by a lot of people.
Why that sort of thing isn't done in a way with science?
I don't know, but this is kind of one way of doing it, and this is actually something, you know, one of the things I'm hoping that will come out of this. Is not what I really like, yeah, exactly, the Nobel Prizes, that would be a great way to do it. They should kind of know who the candidates are or who are the light they should be. And one of the ways that you do this is not for scientists to avoid talking to the press, but instead of waiting for the last minute quote, but to try and form professional networking or links with the press so that they know where to go. You're familiar with a reporter, you know that reporter, and you can work with them, and you actually learn to trust each other. That kind of ongoing relationship, I think, is a really good way to help address some of these things. And again, here's the link.
The approach is that maybe a publication like Nature would specifically prohibit you from doing anything like that before there.
Exactly. There are problems with embargo. Excellent point. And that is actually...
That's like Bernie Lab or Soren have exactly the same policy.
Exactly. And that's a very big frustration for those of us who are trying to cover science news. We like to respect embargoes, but on the other hand, it means... A lot of times, though, they will let the scientists speak if we promise not to publish until after the embargo is lifted. So a lot of times that's how I get around the embargo. I will, you know, because I have trusted scientists who trust me to respect the embargo, that they will talk to me and give me the background, and they will do some fact checking and stuff, so that when I can write it in advance and then do a little bit of update and then run with it. Again, that's an area that we kind of need to work on, and that's where the trust comes in. I think there's a lot of lack of trust. There's a reason for it, very good reason, and one of the ways to kind of start building bridges again is to try and have actual regular connections and relationships with reporters.
Look, the family driveway, but the first thing they teach you in any media course is that you never trust the journalist.
yes, I know.
The
yeah.
editor will come to you and say, I need a feature. I need to fill, this particular piece of newspaper. Do we have a news? And, you know.
That's not quite how it works, but do you want to comment on this, or?
There is, embargoes drive journalists crazy, and they drive us crazy in part because you do your job as a reporter, which is, you know, to try to find stuff out ahead of time, and then you get some terrified scientist who says, I don't want to piss off a major journal. But there is, you're not breaking the embargo to talk to a reporter, and reporters from reputable publications will trust embargoes. Though I do have to admit, there's been some tension, and I'm on Nature's press mailing list, and I'm often amused that they'll send out an email that says "blah under embargo," and then a few hours later, the embargo has been lifted, which of course means somebody broke it. And again, it's due to the competitive nature of journalism. But for the most part, people play by the rules. And hopefully the journals won't be punitive, because they know it's not you who broke it. They know it's the journal. You know, the punishment will go to the publication, not to the scientist.
Yeah, I'd also add that, you know, this is where, you know, Karen and I are actual science writers. We do not write for daily newspapers. I would say that, yes, a daily newspaper reporter you might want to be a little more careful with. But even so, I mean, Dennis Overby of the New York Times actually does try and build relationships with scientists. He's in constant contact with them. And I think he's one of the better reporters about physics that they have writing for them. There were more comments here.
There's one other firm that we encountered. Sarah can remind me of the guy's name. There's a guy that had an assignment to write an article for the New York Times Magazine, and he knew that 6 months ahead of time, and was had a lot of time to prepare it. It could have been better, but...
New York Times Magazine uses freelancers.
It's
an assignment. He had an assignment as a freelancer.
Yeah, but I mean, you can sort of guarantee...
But he's not a staff writer.
He's not a staff writer. There's a difference. You had something?
So I was going to say, though, isn't there a problem built in the system that a large fraction of the reporters are, they've got to have their 3 stories per day, and so they're working full-time every day trying to get those stories out, and they don't really have time to do advance work because they've got their deadline for today that they have to do.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, if I can kind of insert what was going to be in my part right into your part. As Jennifer pointed out, there's different kinds of publications. There's also different kinds of stories within publications. They basically break down into 3, which is news stories, which is the sort of thing we've been talking about, this breaking news. There's features, which are longer leads and have longer time. And then there's profiles, which is when a journalist, you know, the stuff you read in The New Yorker, where there's really time to go at something. And you're absolutely right. On major dailies, it's a crushing workload, and it's time management hell. And this is where the mistakes get made. And sometimes the problem is, too, a lot of science journalism is freelance. So you're trying to balance the story I've got due for this pub, the story I've got due for that pub. And, you know, I guess in a sense, I can only sort of, you know, beg your empathy that in the same way you're trying to do experiments and write grants and counsel grad students and interview postdocs, it's that same sort of schedule where, you know, things start to slip through the cracks.
It's easy to criticize it, but I think we should recognize as scientists, too, that we ought to be thrilled that the public has an appetite, such as it does, for what we do, since we use their money. And whatever we can do to keep that appetite going is a good idea.
David, would you like to comment? And we've actually talked a little bit about this beforehand, and you brought it up earlier. There's different professional standard practices. For most mainstream media, like it or not, you know, I personally like to let the scientist review an article and fact check. And if I write for Physics Today or Industrial Physicist magazine, I'm allowed to do that. If I'm writing for New Scientist or Discover or a newspaper, I can't. I'm not allowed. I will do everything I can to do the fact checking and stuff, but we've already talked a little bit about what happens when the copy editor gets their hands on it. You know, my version can be great, you know. And I've actually shown Sean before and after versions of my articles, and he's just been appalled at just what happens. And then I managed to go back and fix it at the last minute. But
there are marks on my apartment wall from where I thrown.
Improving English, they destroy the
slide. Yeah. It's actually more that they try and fit it to space. I'm usually about 150 words over, and so they try and like cram a whole lot of really big ideas into one paragraph, and they conflate, and then they lose nuance, and sometimes it's just outright wrong.
But you're also right that some of it is they think they're fixing your language, and
it's like, no, there's a reason I used that word. That word has a very specific meaning.
So.
I'm not expressing the frustration of the scientists, exactly the frustration that the scientists sometimes feel with the reporters.
Exactly. And what I'm basically trying.
The editors here, we're blaming them for everything.
What I'm actually hoping to make clear is that it's not always the reporter's fault. Sometimes it is. I have made mistakes, and I accept responsibility for the times when I do. But sometimes it is actually not my fault.
As a reporter, can choose not to work with editors.
Yes. Yes, and actually there is a, I won't name names, but there is one editor that I refuse to work with at an unnamed publication just because I just don't trust what they do with my copy.
So how often do you get to see the edited copy after?
Oh, they usually run it past me. But in general, what happens is they run it past me, and then I get to say, oh, God, no, you've got to fix this, and can we do this? But then I don't see it after that point, and if a last-minute change gets made, I have no control over that.
I understand there is this rule. But since, you know, you have house visitors today.
Oh. I have made.
No rule that,
there is no rule that prevents me. And actually, I did a piece when I just started dating Sean. We're married, by the way. For those of you who don't know. But I wrote a piece for New Scientist on a paper that had come out, basically a new model for the cosmological constant involving soap bubbles. And I almost never write about that theory, particularly cosmology, but I have written about foam and bubbles, so I got assigned this story. And I was just in way over my head, and there were a lot of panicked emails and phone calls to Sean, and I was not allowed to quote him in the article. He was not one of my sources, but he was my fact checker and, you know, translator, I should say, because the paper was just incomprehensible.
So I'm a little surprised that people don't
take better advantage of it.
Get their own private fact checkers.
Trust me, it doesn't help. The problem is it's this game of telephone between you and your editor. And can you guys hear me, by the way?
Yeah. This is not amplifying, it's a recording.
Oh, okay. Okay. If you have a good editor, and I have had some who are wonderful, you've got someone who can catch you when you fall. But often editors are really there to be generalist, to think like they think they're thinking like the reader, although they usually seem to think the reader is dumber than the reader actually is.
What that says about the editor.
But what happens, unfortunately, and I'm thinking of one piece that was a nightmare. It was an astrophysicist at Caltech who spent a lot of time with me, and I sent him copy, and we went back and forth and back and forth. We had it absolutely perfect. I sent it into the editor. It comes back. My favorite change that I remember is the rovers had traversed a wide swath of the Martian landscape. And I'm like, since when is 8 miles a wide swath? And this is after we had done everything we could. And so, you know, it really comes down to a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And if you've got a good conscientious reporter and a good editor, you're going to wind up with an article that makes you happy. If you have an editor who for some reason thinks they know more than the reporter does, they know more than the expert sources do, there's just no preventing disaster. And I basically had to go through having this poor scientist who had spent so much time with me call me up and yell at me when the article came out. So.
I think I can just whip through this one because this is, I think we all agree on this, the dreaded B word, balance. This can be both a good and bad thing. It's a fundamental tenet of journalism. You have to present both sides always. Journalists are trained. It's drilled into us from day one. It's important. It can guard against too credible reporting, something like cold fusion, any kind of fraudulent thing. It's especially important when you're talking about politics or other kinds of issues. The problem is, of course, that there is a scientific consensus that does emerge on certain issues, and that is often not reflected in the journalistic coverage. I'm going to let Sean probably talk about that a little bit more. I'm only bringing it up because I think that as scientists, you have to recognize that this is a fundamental principle. Once you recognize that, then you can figure out how to help change that. I think that's one of the things that we can help change in terms of science coverage. I actually got this comment on my blog, why don't reporters tell the truth instead of cherry-picking quotes to bolster their own biased point of view? This was from a very bitter scientist who had been burned. And it is sometimes a valid complaint. I can think of a couple of reporters offhand who are guilty of this. But it is, in fact, a rare and, I think, a very bad reporter who deliberately sets out to misrepresent someone in an article. It is a reporter's job to shape an article into a strong narrative. That's a big difference, though. I mean, I'm talking about lending structure and context and picking good quotes that illustrate and that sort of thing. And you're sort of creating a sort of point of view and a framework, but it's not skewing the facts to fit your pet theory. And I think that this comment was a direct response to skewing the facts to fit a pet theory. And if a reporter is doing that, it's a bad reporter. He should not be going into it with a preconceived notion like that. This is something that I'm surprised a lot of you don't know. Reporters don't write the headlines. a number of good friends of mine who are physicists have said, I didn't know that. I thought that you guys wrote your own headlines. I says, yeah, well, I sometimes take a stab at it, but they always change it. And it's like, the editors, the copy editors, sometimes they have a headline writer. Other people are writing your headlines. I really miss Bloom County. And this is a perfect example. The reporter goes to his editor and, you know, says, look, you know, a two-year-old tot actually, you know, smacked a cat in the middle of the produce section, and that's what the editor comes up with. It gives you, and I think that we have all seen, you know, less exaggerated examples of this in the media. But it does go into the point that we've been making, that there are a lot of other folks involved in the process of bringing a science story to press, depending on whether it's a newspaper or a magazine or TV or radio. But you can have a publisher, an editor-in-chief, there's section editors, there's copy editors, there's photo editors, layout and graphic designers, headline and caption writers. That's just a few. So you can see, you know, all these people have their little fingers in your particular pie. You can see how, like, things creep in. It's also why misquotation happens, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I think that we're going to be dealing with this a lot in the discussion. I think this is a very, very common problem. It's definitely happened to me. I got profiled by a reporter for a local newspaper, and I didn't even recognize myself. And she got everything wrong. You know, she actually quoted me in such a way that it said the exact opposite of what I'd meant. It was my first real experience of being burned. Ironically, I found that the smaller publications, the literary publications and things, do much better than the daily newspapers when it comes to this. And I think, again, part of it's a function of the time constraints. Who decides what stories get covered and where stories get placed? That is not the reporter, unfortunately. That's editors and publishers. And that's going to bring me to my last point. Some bad news for science. The Pew Annual State of the Media report came out. This is more for cable TV news specifically, but you can just look at those numbers. In terms of every 5 hours of cable TV news, you get 35 minutes on campaigns and elections, 26 minutes of crime, 12...
What's the difference between those top two?
I don't know. 12 minutes of celebrity and entertainment, and exactly 1 minute about science and technology, maybe another minute about health and medicine. We've seen the enemy, Britney Spears. She gets more media coverage than science and technology, the environment, education, and healthcare combined on cable TV news. This is what I was talking about when I was talking about the conglomerations, these giant corporate conglomerations that have been taking over the mainstream media and that have kind of, I do think that you're going to see more and more niche publications popping up, particularly with online media, because people are very frustrated by this. People are interested in science, and we shouldn't have to tweak everything to talk about the materials physics of Britney Spears' bikini to get people interested in science. I do think they're naturally interested in it. I'm going to end with finding common ground, another quote by Mariette. Both of us, scientists and journalists, want to get a good story that's clear and pleasing to our readers. So I think being understanding about each other's limitations is most helpful of all. And I'm kind of hoping that I've helped shed a little bit of light about how the process works. I am going to turn it over to Sean, and he's going to talk a little bit about his experiences as a scientist and some of the strategies he's come up with to deal with the very different needs and different formats. And he's definitely got some great stories.
So I'm going to remain seated as an intentional rhetorical strategy to undermine my own authority, because I'm sure that many of you in the audience have been interviewed in the media or whatever just as much as I have, but I was asked to be on the panel, so I got to sit down and think about what the relationship should be like, what we can do to make it better, and so forth. And what I wanted to do, what I'm trained to do, is to come up with a theory, like a single unifying principle that would make it all clear. But I was unable to do that. So, it's closer to botany. So I collected some stamps, and I have some. I'll start by giving you three anecdotes, and you can probably abstract yourself everything I have to say from those anecdotes, but then I try to put it into list form after that. So the first anecdote, which just illustrates something we've already talked about several times now, is that the very first time I had to deal with media as a scientist, I was a graduate student, and with Alan Guth and Eddie Fari, we worked on, could you build a time machine out of cosmic strings? If you have parallel cosmic strings, you can ignore the direction they're going along, so you can make a simple mathematical model of a three-dimensional space-time instead of a four-dimensional space-time, and it becomes possible to solve the equations, and you can ask whether or not you can make closed time-like curves, as Richard Gott had suggested you could. And we wrote two papers on it, and we were interviewed by Ron Cowan of Science News, and Science News is actually pretty close to almost the professional press compared to a lot of the popular press. So they do a very, very careful job. He interviewed us a lot, made absolutely sure that he understood what was going on, and we did get to see the article before it appeared in print to check it for accuracy. And like Jennifer said, this almost never happens, so don't get used to it. We read it. It looked really, really good. We sent it back in, and then it appeared in print, and we looked at it, and the editor had helpfully added one little line in between the version we saw where it appeared in print, and he explained that an open universe is one that expands forever, whereas a closed universe is one that recontracts. A statement that is true in four space-time dimensions, but not true in three space-time dimensions where we were working. And if we had found that line, we would have taken it out. So that's one story. I will not draw any morals from it. The second story is I was at in the audience at a panel discussion where one of the people on the panel was David Kestenbaum, NPR science reporter who does a lot of physics. He was a particle physicist as a PhD student at Harvard. And he played us some tape of an NPR reporter, radio reporter, interviewing a biologist about avian flu and whether or not the Bronx Zoo was a threat, whether or not some birds were going to fly into the zoo and then give flu to everyone in the New York area. And so the you hear the scientist who's being interviewed say, well, you have to understand that in an open system, you have a complex ecosystem and the different disease vectors can, you know, and the reporter goes, wait, just stop. And he says, we talked about this before. Is the zoo a threat to send the flu around or not? And the scientist goes, no, of course not. And so the reporter goes, okay, I would like you to say that when I'm recording you and then we will play that. And the scientist goes, okay, sure. And the reporter goes, is the zoo a threat? And the scientist goes, well, we have many different variables in your system, and you have an open, there's no boundaries, rapid fire, and completely incomprehensible. So you can take the moral from that as well. The final anecdote is 2 years ago, the WMAP team released its three-year data results. So the first year data results were very impressive and interesting, won Science Magazine's Breakthrough of the Year, established what we now call the concordance cosmology with dark matter, dark energy, etc., and was a big story, easy to tell. The third year data results were, you know, just as good as science, right? People worked just as hard and so forth, but it was more a matter of confirming things we already suspected were true. There were less obvious breakthroughs. But science, you know, satellite collects useful data is not a headline you will ever see in any magazine. So the scientists tried, I mean, this is NASA. NASA is the only agency that I know of that actually keeps track of how many column inches in the world's newspapers are devoted to stories about their missions. This is a metric for success. So they wanted to be printed in the newspaper, and so they tried to sell it. And the one thing that they had was that there was a measurement of the difference in amplitude of density perturbations on different length scales. And inflation predicts that this should be almost exactly the same amplitude, but not quite. And the satellite found that at the 3 sigma level, it was almost exactly flat, but not quite. So an interesting result, intriguing, not at all definitive, but at least worth talking about. And so this might be evidence for inflation. And so the scientists tried to get across to the journalists the idea that somehow we were learning something about the first 10 to the minus 30 seconds of the universe's history, even though we were looking at something that happened 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Not all the scientists were especially scrupulous about making quite that distinction. So the headlines that appeared included, "Astronomers detect first split second of the universe." "University physicists see origin of cosmos." And so these are the ones that sort of spun the story by making it more dramatic than it was. But then the opposite also happened. You also read, "Evidence for Big Bang seen." We kind of already have a lot of evidence for the Big Bang, so I didn't know that. And my favorite was, "Evidence for expansion of the universe found." That is not hot news today. That would have been hot news in 1927, but you know. So making that leap from interesting science to digestible news is a very difficult one to do, both for the scientists and for the journalists. So I think that in the very big picture, we're on the same side, basically. But scientists and journalists have a different set of constraints and goals to work under. So what I tried to do, without talking to any journalists myself, was to invent a list of things that journalists want. What do journalists want? This is what I think that I've come up with. So the first thing, the journalists want stories to be interesting. And you say, that's okay, I want stories to be interesting too. But the journalist's idea of what is interesting might not be the same as your idea of what is interesting. I once wrote a paper about the origin of the universe, which I thought was interesting, and I talked to a journalist about it, and in the process of telling the story, I mentioned that we did the calculation in the paper, and we came up with a number which was possibly the smallest positive number ever to appear in a physics paper, 10 to the minus 10 to the 10 to the 50, something like that. And she said, "Oh, that's great, let's make the story about that." And I said, "Well, it's not that interesting. It might not be true. I'm just guessing. There could be smaller numbers elsewhere." And she refused. She ended up writing the story about that. And I'm like, "No, the origin of the universe, that's what's interesting." And so I stopped, you know, being involved with that particular story. But therefore, I guess the lesson is that you should try to exert some influence over at least explaining why certain things are interesting, certain things are less interesting. But they have different constraints, so they might have different conclusions. The second thing is, journalists like things to be understandable. And I think, again, you would say, well, I want also things to be understandable. And I think that any good journalist, and most of them are good, really wants to be conveying some information accurately. But many times the journalist is less good, or there's a constraint, either because it's, you know, you want something visually appealing or you have a short deadline. They are willing to accept the illusion of understanding, even if true understanding is absent. So I was interviewed a while ago on camera for a History Channel documentary about dark matter. And they'd come up, someone had explained that there was a good possible analogy where you could spin something on a rope around your head, and that has to do with gravity. So they had me stand there and I spun something around the rope in my head. And that's okay. I'm willing to humiliate myself in the greater cause. But then I was talking to the director of the show and said, "So, am I the dark matter? What is representing what?" And they had no idea. They're like, "Well, I don't know. What do you think? Should you be the dark matter?" And they really wanted to be spinning. They weren't sure what it was supposed to be telling anybody. And so again, you can be a little bit active in taking that role and saying, "No, let's first decide what we're trying to get across, and then choose the analogy." Likewise, it's probably the same thing. Journalists like things to be tangible. They're not, you know, they're writing for a non-expert audience, obviously, and it's hard for us to remember, but when we were first learning quantum mechanics or curved space time or you know, the real number line or whatever, it's abstract, and it wasn't immediately clear to us. And in the course of a short individual story, you're not going to take some really abstract thing and make it understandable purely at the level of abstraction. So they want analogies and metaphors and illustrations to bring things down to earth. And if you don't provide them, they might just start making them up. So to come up with ones that you think are actually illuminating is very useful. Things that journalists do not want, they do not consider it their job to provide science education. And this is a difference that other various journalists have tried to emphasize to me, and I'm still not quite sure I understand, but they're like, we're not a school, we're reporting the news. So to scientists, it's just as important to get people to understand the basics of the whole field, and journalists are less willing to take the time out to do that, that you know, they want this, they think that that's the job of schools or books or something like that, and you need to take that into consideration. And perhaps most importantly, in terms of a difference in goals, journalists are not all that fascinated by the allocation of credit to different sets of people. Scientists and academics more generally live and die by who gets credit, right? I mean, we're not in it for the money, or we didn't make a very smart decision if we're in it for the money, but getting your name attached to what you do is crucially, crucially important. And so when you're on a collaboration with five co-authors or whatever, you think that all of your co-authors should be listed in the newspaper article. And it's unlikely in a newspaper article. It might happen in a magazine. It's never going to happen in the radio or TV or something like that. And that's a fairly mild case. The much worse cases are where there are two groups of people who did a similar thing, and the journalist writes about one of them. And they're just not, they want to get the substance of the story across. They're much, much less interested in making sure that everyone gets a name check, or every funding agency gets mentioned, or every single instrument or telescope that was built gets mentioned. So again, you need to take that into consideration, figure out what your priorities are about who gets credit, and try to make that clear to the journalist. The one goal that both scientists and journalists should have, and I feel this is kind of underemphasized, is that making sure that in the story only true statements appear. No false statements. So, and again, this is, we all agree that this is true, but because of these other constraints, because of time constraints and space constraints and the attempts to make things clear, believe it or not, people begin to sacrifice telling the truth and making true statements like, you know, astronomers see origin of universe. You know, people said when they were interviewed for WMAP, this is the evidence that inflation is right. And that statement is not true. There's a more nuanced statement one could make. And the journalists need to understand that the illusion of understanding is not something that should be given into at the expense of telling the truth. Scientists need to understand that being interesting is not worth sacrificing telling the truth. Ultimately, there's no reason, it defeats the entire purpose if anything appears in a news story that is just not true. I think that's worth emphasizing. So to finish up, I came up with a short list of things that you can do as a scientist to make what appears in the media better. And the single most important one is to think ahead of time what you want to say. Especially, this is true and a little bit counterintuitive, if you're going to be interviewed, especially live, but even taped ahead of time on the radio or something like that. Because you think in your mind, I'm going to be interviewed. They're going to ask a question. I'm going to answer it. So I don't need to prepare because I don't know what the question is yet. And that is completely wrong because, number one, you probably know what the questions are going to be. Like, if you're any working cosmologist and you don't know an answer to the question, what is the universe expanding into, you haven't done your job, right? You can anticipate a lot of these things. But also, you might not be right. The journalist might actually not have had the time to do the background work and figure out what are the right questions to ask. And in that case, they are more often than not going to be thankful to you you to let them know what questions there are. If you can say, well, actually, what I think you should be thinking about is this, that will be enormously helpful. Not to mention the fact that, of course, that if you've thought about your explanation ahead of time, you're much likely to be clear and not be misquoted and come out saying something smart. If you come up with analogies ahead of time, again, they like that. So if you can explain that visible matter is 4% of the total matter in the universe, that's useful. If you can say, well, the visible matter is like the olive in the martini of the dark matter, then they will love you forever. And you will get quoted in all of the newspaper articles. Whatever that means, but it's a small but important ingredient, and it's the one you see, right? It's a true statement, both true and conveys an impression, I think, that is mostly true. Think ahead of time, and this is hard because it sounds a little vague. Think ahead of time of the words that you use when you try to explain things, because it's hard for us as experts, as professionals trained in a field, to realize that we're using terms of art. Number one, we invent new terms of art and then use them in mutually inconsistent ways. We say Big Bang. Sometimes we mean the Big Bang Theory, the whole thing that is 14 billion years of expansion from a hot, dense state. Sometimes we mean the singularity at the very beginning. We're not always telling people who are not experts which one we mean, because it's obvious to us. But more often, we're using borrowed words from ordinary language in different ways. I mean, it was very recently that it occurred to me, finally, that the word dimension doesn't mean the same thing to a person on the street, especially if you say there are extra dimensions. You know, we mean, well, there's one, two, three, and maybe there's another one that we can't see. And they think that a dimension is a place that aliens come from. There's another dimension over there, and they're getting there, right? And maybe they will attack. And it's not, you can't blame them for that, but you can anticipate it ahead of time. Words like energy and space that we use all the time have a different meaning in people's minds. And so thinking of those words ahead of time is useful. What else? Take on an active role. So to try to not only make the words that you say clear, but to actually have a give and take with the journalist and try to figure out whether or not they get it. Do they appreciate what are the major parts of the story? They're on a deadline. They're in a hurry. They like being told, oh, what is really more interesting would be this. That's not doing their job for them. That's helping them out. It can be very useful. And, you know, if you can boil it down, you know, catchphrases, we make fun of people about, you know, having sound bites and so forth. But the motivation that should be going on in your mind when you're talking to a journalist is, what do I want a person who reads this story to remember a year from now about the story? It's not going to be some long explanation. It's going to be a less than or equal to one sentence of 12 words. So if you can't boil it down to one 12-word sentence, then why are you even doing this? I mean, there needs to be a message that you're trying to get across. And to try to think of that ahead of time and to make it both as accurate and as understandable ahead of time as you can is going to make you look good and going to make the journalist very, very happy. Yes?
Can I add one more thing the journalists want? Not all of them, but you're yes. Reading this time and time again. The journalists seem to love the concept of one lone scientist struggling against
the maverick.
Yeah, I mean, more broadly than that.
The story.
People want stories. People want drama, and people want human beings. And yeah, I mean, human interest stories. And you know what? That's not bad. The question is, because there are human interest stories, but we're trained, and it's not, and you know, this is actually very interesting in the history of science. This didn't arise organically. People sat down there during the Enlightenment and said, when we write science papers, here are the techniques we will use to make them as inhuman and sounding as universal and objective as possible. We will use we, even if I'm the only author on the paper. This is a choice that people made a long time ago, because it's an attempt to make things as objective and non-human as possible. But when you're talking to a wider audience, you have to remember that's not necessarily the best way to do it. I mean, if there is some human drama in there, then that's okay. You don't want it to replace telling the story, but if it gets people interested in some science, then by all means use it. Of course, you want it to be accurate, you want it to be true. It's often not an individual story, and this goes back into the allocation of credit. If there's one person who's a really who's either good at explaining things or has a compelling personal story, their name is going to appear more in the media than someone who is working just as hard and just as valuable to the collaboration, but less eloquent or less colorful or something like that. And you can decide for yourself how much you're going to get angry about that, or how much you're just going to use it to help the cause of science more generally.
I think the other aspect of the human nature is that, unfortunately, scientists are generally considered by the public to be automatons. And it's not bad to say, hey, we have senses of humor, we have family, we have likes and dislikes. We're human beings just like you, and the public needs to know that.
I was wondering about the role of controversy, because press also feeds on that. It sells paper, it sells newspaper, everything else. There are legitimate controversies. How are they handled? And how about the insertion or exaggeration of controversy in order to sort of color a story and make it saleable?
If I can kind of answer both questions that sort of segue, I have to say, as a journalist, it frustrates me because, again, this goes back into things that are sort of built into the system, this desire for narrative, this desire for story. And story itself can be a distortion. I mean, I think all of you know, one of the greatest distortions was written by a scientist. It was James Watson's The Double Helix. And he kind of set this template where science has to be this competing race, and there are winners and there are losers. And too many of us fall into that. And you're very right about this Maverick. It drives me crazy because there's a book.
Compared to narratives that scientists gave, you know, before Watson, closer to reality.
Well, you're
that was why it was interesting.
Granted, there's that, but there's certainly subtleties he kept out of the story, and it was Watson, who's not a subtle person. But unfortunately, I think it really did set this notion of science has to be a zero-sum game, which I think is sort of a distortion of contemporary science that do not necessarily have to be winners and losers.
The most interesting thing is who he made winners and who he made.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's another book called The Emperor of Scent, and it does exactly what you were complaining about. It takes this maverick, Luca Turin, who is pretty much despised by every olfaction scientist out there, and it makes him be the guy who's got the answer, but the establishment won't recognize his genius. And it's just painful to read. I mean, it makes Linda Buck and Richard Axel, who won the Nobel Prize, look like the villains of the story. And, you know, all I can say on behalf of...
Well, it's a dribble because no matter where you go and give a talk on olfaction, there's always somebody with a question about Luca Turin's vibrational theory of bullshit.
Exactly! Thank you!
The answer to this question is
even weeks long.
Chandler Burr, the writer, now writes the perfume column for the New York Times. Yeah, and if you want to get journalists going.
So, you know, there was an interesting history in that, though, that I don't think is often looked at, which is that book got extremely good reviews. But if you look at who reviewed it, it was almost all journalists and literary reviewers. There were no science reviews for that book.
Yeah.
There was one that I know of in Nature and Neuroscience, which
trashed it, which is Avery Gilbert's review, right? Yeah.
But all the other reviews, the ones that appeared in the Times and things like that, were Janet Mason reviewed it for the Times. And what was that all about? They were very kind to it as a narrative.
Exactly, it's exactly what Jennifer said. It's this great story of Maverick up against the big bad establishment. And yeah, it's a heartbreaker because, you know, then as you very well know, there's people like Linda and Richard going, what I'm trying to say essentially is that we feel your pain. I mean, every field has people who suck, you know.
Yeah, but in physics, there's Richard Feynman.
Yeah.
Now, Richard Feynman actually write the book himself. He called the soul. I heard him though. And so he wrote books which are sort of self-promoting. In fact, some people said he did a lot of things just to be able to tell stories about them. but that is a book which has made scientists much more human and admirable to a lot of people. I mean, theoretical physics in particular to a lot of people who know nothing about physics.
I mean, I was actually going to play devil's advocate too and just say I'm a big fan of story. I mean, I think that yes, you do get these cliched maverick, you know, things. But the reason that book was reviewed so positively is, first of all, the literary people didn't have the science. They didn't know he was a crank. And whoever wrote the book, was it him or someone else? Told a very, very compelling story in the same way that Feynman was able to create his own mythology. That's a very powerful thing, and I think that we want to shoot for, you know, creative stories that actually are accurate, or at least, you know, have at least new characters and not just your average maverick again. But definitely it's an example of how powerful it can be.
Yeah, but there does point to a problem here, which is shared by Lee Smolin and Laura Lopez, is that those things which, you know, those in the know are not to be taken very seriously. Those are not in the know can be captivated by them.
Right, absolutely, yeah. So.
And so, you know, these are recent examples of
real shiny
failures.
Yeah.
Failures of the communication.
One thing we see in physics today when we send out a book for review.
People will refuse. They'll read
the book and they say, you know, I don't want to review because I don't want to be critical in public of my colleague or this author. And they'll just back off from reviewing it. So that's why you don't get negative reviews very often from the same.
This is actually, we're not, in Sean's points of what scientists can do to help us, frankly, you could be more honest. Because I've had a lot of scientists say, so-and-so's work is doing some yoga, but it's terrible, it distorts this, that, and the other thing, but please God, don't write that. And we need you to be a little bolder and critical, not in a nasty way, but in an explanatory way.
I think what the scientists are afraid of, and I could see this happening, they review a book in a negative way, they're going to get embroiled in controversy. This can take your time, and that's not necessarily a fight they might want to take on.
But look, there's a much more positive looking way to deal with these things. It is possible to use compelling stories and a good writing style in the service of statements that might not be true. A friend of mine who's a string theorist, who I won't name, recently was complaining that a new graduate student walked into his office and said, for a long time I've wanted to do fundamental physics and quantized gravity, but I understand that now the whole string theory bandwagon has fallen apart and the new thing is to, you know, to use loop quantum gravity and so forth, so could I do that? And he's shrugging his shoulders, says, what can we do in the face of this kind of thing? And the answer is, tell a compelling, well-written, correct story. I think that there is a story to be told about... Well, no, but that's not enough. You got to keep telling it. Then you can tell it in many different ways.
You're absolutely right, the competition of ideas. But here we have examples of really frank, or almost frank, who have had, you know, influence out of proportion to what these things are doing. And who really do a lot of distortion. And I think that is an indication, at least in what I thought it would be the case of the string theory, you know, book, of just the media and wanting this kind of controversy.
No, and this comes with the balance, right? I mean, if the establishment is against something, it can't be all bad, right?
Aside from just, you know, combating that for every one of those things, you know, you have 10 books, so that takes a lot to bury that. I think it's a question of dealing with it more. I mean, that shouldn't have you got to stop at the beginning, as if these reviews probably made all the difference.
But that's right. So part of that is pointing out things that are incorrect and being honest about it and as polite and respectful while being honest as possible. But another thing is to make a positive case. I think that the one thing that didn't get put forward in the string theory case as well as it could have is, no, even though we have not yet made predictions for the LHC, there's really good reasons.
Your duty is take these guys seriously, go out and debate them. It didn't work, and they, after a while, they realized this was not the way to do it.
No, I think it's a little bit different. I'm not saying, treat both sides equally and fairly and so forth, but I do think that in the case of evolution or the case of string theory or whatever, they're not quite analogous, but it is always our duty to not take for granted that people who are non-experts think that we're on the right track just because we're experts. We need to explain the motivations for, why you're spending 30 years working on something without the results that you were hoping to get. What keeps you optimistic about that? And I'm not saying it's all you need to do, but it has to be a necessary component of fighting against these. You can't expect journalists and book reviewers and so forth just to pick up that this guy is not presenting the detail of the science right.
You could say that there's bit of a positive spin on some of this. I suspect that more people are interested in the olfactory system.
They heard about it,
and it's potentially correctable. I suppose same thing is true of finding the glad, you could say.
Yeah, I didn't look at the story more positive.
I will let Karen talk. I just want to, I do want to iterate, I kind of agree with David on the string wars thing, because I actually know some of the reporters that worked on that, and some of them were very careful, but a couple of the others were kind of lazy. It's a great story, let's run with it, it's like, let's play it up, and it ended up just kind of, it became this sort of snowballing effect, and it got blown way out of proportion. These were the two books that came out at the same time, one of them was almost unreadable, it was so dense. There's no way an average person could have even gotten past 10 pages. So why did it get as much attention as it did?
It's a compelling David and Goliath story.
A compelling David and Goliath story. Again, you've got that archetype, yes.
So how far does that balance go? Because suppose you have somebody who comes tomorrow and says, well, we don't think that the Pythagorean theorem is really correct.
Yeah.
So actually, some of the statements that are done about evolutionary theory are about the lack of intellectual strength.
Yeah, you're being generous, actually. and that's actually the problem with the balance that we brought up. Unfortunately, that has often been the case. There actually were a couple of like cover stories. There was one in, the Washington Post, and another one in the New York Times, that I was really kind of upset about, because they gave way too much space to equal space to this intelligent design argument that actually is not on an equal footing scientifically at all. And I think that is something that we can work to change. That's certainly what I try and do when I talk to journalists who are covering science for the first time or covering a science story. Says you have to understand that this particular beat is unique in this respect, that there is a consensus, that there are things that really do not carry equal weight with some crackpot thesis over here. And that's just a question of getting the message out there.
I'd like to get Karen back in.
Yeah.
Oh. Thank you.
We would like to get Karen back, yes.
Thanks. Well, we've been talking, I think, a lot about theoretical stuff, so now I've, scratched out most of my notes. So I will cut to the stuff that's just really pragmatic to give you some pointers. And in saying some of this, before I was, before and sort of in between being a journalist, I was a publicist. So I do know media training, and I do know the kind of, again, protecting yourself from journalists. So to give you some, hopefully practical advice, one of the things that to understand, and I've had this happen to me a lot, is, as Jennifer pointed out, you've got to know the nature of the publication you're talking to. You've got to know the nature of the kind of story it is. Because again, a news piece is going to have a fast deadline, it's going to be very short, and really all they've got time for is one or two, just give me what I need quotes. A feature story, you can take an hour with that reporter, you can take the time to give all the background and get it right. But what's most important is to understand not who the reporter is, but who their audience is. Because even if you're talking to someone who has a PhD in physics and then turned to journalism, if they're writing for USA Today, that PhD is not going to help. And you've got to pull down what you're saying. Conversely, I used to write for something called the Scientist magazine that assumed that at the very least, most people reading it had a PhD in molecular biology. At the time, I had a BA in screenwriting. And, you know, I would talk to scientists and I would say, look, I have a tape recorder running. I'm going to ask you the question. Do not scale your answer to me. Speak as if you were talking directly scientist to scientist. Some of them could do it, but some of them, you know, they kind of kept seeing me and they would answer in metaphor and mushy analogies. So again, listen very specifically to who the audience is. Ask very specifically. You know, you're welcome to say, who is your audience? What is your deadline? How many words do you have for this story? Which will give you a lot of the context you need for framing your answers. Flipping to a part of the video we haven't covered yet. The other thing is, it is okay, depending on the time, and it's also fine to ask the reporter and say, how much time do you have for my answer? Because I've had some great interviews with scientists where maybe the first 10 or 15 minutes is the stuff my story is on, and the next 45 is on the stuff they're currently working on, which becomes my background for me, you know, a story I might do 6 months from now. So take advantage of that. If the reporter's got the time, and again, a feature writer likely will have that kind of time. The other is, and this is kind of referenced by Sean, you're dealing with two levels of ignorance. You know, one, okay, you go in assuming I'm a physicist, reporter doesn't have a clue what I'm talking about, but it's worse than that. It's that the reporter watched Nova 6 months ago, and they think they know string theory, and you start to talk to them, and it's falling into this badly understood, Brian Greene said something. And so you often find that you have to correct this misinterpreted frame that everything is falling into, and be very much aware of that. I mean, Sean's point was very well taken. You're going to use terms, and they're going to think they understood you, and they don't. The other thing is, you're noticing I'm not using PowerPoint. I can tell you that I'm not using PowerPoint because I'm a writer and words are my business. Or I can tell you that I'm not using PowerPoint because I suck at PowerPoint. Either one, you have now learned information that I volunteered. You don't have to volunteer information. Because unless someone is doing an in-depth profile of you, they are not going to have the time, they are not going to have the resources to search out everything in your life. So you really can craft what your answer is, how you come across. I mean, obviously you want to tell the truth, but you don't have to tell all the truth if it doesn't make you look good. And another thing to be very much aware of is where, especially again for feature writing, we're looking for color, we're looking for something to add to the story. Bill Bialik, who some of you may know, he's a Princeton physicist, computational neuroscientist, once complained to me, why do they always describe what tie I'm wearing? And it's because we're looking. And the problem is that we as journalists are looking to humanize you. So the problem is if we come up to the lab visit, and that's the one day you happen to pull out the Babylon 5 t-shirt, we're going to write, he dresses like a typical science nerd. So, you know, again, you can craft how you come across because we don't know that much and we probably don't have time to check that much. dirty little secret.
I have to say, Los Angeles Times did a post Nobel Prize fashion story.
Oh, that was dreadful.
They kept all the Nobel winners on how well they were dressed in the pictures that were released to the media.
Yes. Pretty hideous. I thought
the
hair
looked great.
Yeah. Doris Lessing was really messy.
Yeah.
The choices,
sort of an Academy Awards.
No, the day after, whatever snapshot they had.
Yeah.
Well, I was in England. Doris Lessing was seated on the steps of the show.
Jaunty red scarf.
They thought she had jaunty red scarves. So badly.
Well, it's creative. Sorry. Get away with it. The other thing, of course, the three most dangerous words in the language for any source, off the record. There is no such thing as off the record. All it means to our ears is you didn't get it from me. If one of you says, off the record, it sounds like the NSF might cut our funding, my next phone call is to the NSF. You know, I heard somewhere. If you don't want us to know it, don't. Dangerous. Useful, but dangerous. I mean, useful because it's true, sometimes you do have to set up the context for what you're saying. And this goes to, you guys complain, where do the mistakes come from? Often they're unintentional. I had a source who gave me context off the record, on background, just to set up why he was telling me something. I wrote my article. My editor said, I don't understand why you have this quote. So I said, well, he told me off the record, blah, 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 this is the context. And my editor was not evil. It was just an accident. You know, he took down his notes. And he was on deadline, he was fast, I could see you anticipating the punchline. The off-the-record stuff winds up in the article.
As a quote.
Exactly, as a quote.
Yeah.
This is the thing about the underpowered. Believe me, if there's no, with any reporter, there's no such thing as retroactive off the record. The other thing to be aware of is, as far as a reporter is concerned, on the record is immediate. If I call you up, you are on the record the moment you pick up that phone. And in some cases, especially if I'm a reporter, God forbid, with an agenda, if my story is that things are going bad in your lab, and you pick up the phone in an irritated, hello? I mean, he was even short-tempered on the phone. The other thing is, no matter how smart you are, you cannot outsmart a dumb reporter. If someone has an agenda, they're going to nail you. And the only way around it is just to keep it as short and tight as possible. I will give you some examples of the trick. Do you think American physics is underfunded? If you answer that by saying, no, it's not underfunded, as a matter of fact, if you think it's overfunded, okay, so you can hear what I'm going for. But if you answer by saying, no, it's not overfunded, in fact, it's terribly underfunded, if you've given me that quote, I can write, despite what he or she has said about American physics being underfunded, you can just look around and see how glorious the institute is. Don't give me the ammunition. Do not paraphrase. Go straight to your answer that negates my setup question.
Talking about that, one of the things I found useful is to ask your own questions.
Yeah, that definitely.
When you ask a question that you don't want to answer, or it's not obvious how to answer, you just rephrase the question and answer your own question.
Absolutely. I mean, it's got to be your words. And I've had scientists, who are sharp enough to do that. Like, you said it, I didn't. and will just stop me cold if I'm going off in the wrong direction. Also,
Yeah, I just want to say, I like what she said about, you know, you cannot outsmart a donor quarter. If it's there, they have to get you, they're going to get you.
Why do the parties have to be done to one?
I just keep lying. I would say, you know, basically, if you have a reporter with an agenda who doesn't like you or is out to get you or has a point to make, then it doesn't matter what you say or how carefully you phrase it, they're going to find a way to twist it. And again, I like her. It did happen to me once in college when I actually, the person just stand back at me. And I was very naive and I answered honestly and I just got just character assassinated.
Oh, God.
And I learned the hard way.
So what would your recommendation be?
I would like you to be a little more specific on how you would answer that question, because that's probably how I'd answer it. No, it's not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, in other words, you don't paraphrase their setup. You know, is American physics overfunded? You know, the instinct is to say, no, it's not. Leave that part out. Just go straight to, it is underfunded. Here's why.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Don't pick up from them. The other thing is, if any of you do video, you notice I'm nodding a lot. It's a normal kind of human gesture. And another trap people get into in video situations is it's normal as someone is speaking, you know, do you believe intelligent design is, you know, sent here by God and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, as much as you're all thinking, oh, that's ridiculous, your gesture as someone is asking the question is to politely nod to show you're following along. Well, if the camera is cutting to you nodding, yes, yes. So if you're ever on video, you're just rock solid.
Or the opposite, rolling your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they'll get you. You know, if you can do the rolling your eyes gesture, but you know, often. Yeah. Well, the rolling.
They can cut it out of you.
Yeah, that's true too.
Again, if they want to get you, they'll get you.
Yeah. Just to wrap up a couple of other pieces of practical advice. The publicists, you know, they're university publicists you may deal with, there may be book publicists you may deal with. Publicists and journalists are kind of like the RAF and the Luftwaffe. They may be on different sides, but they tell the same war stories. And if a publicist goes out drinking with a journalist, all the stuff that you thought you were telling the publicist in confidence may come spilling out.
After that third margarita.
Absolutely. I know some things about scientists I shouldn't, and they come through the publicist. So watch yourself. Finally, in conclusion, this kind of goes back to dumb questions, but nice dumb questions. Sometimes we ask dumb questions because we really don't know what we're talking about. Sometimes we ask some questions strategically. And my absolute favorite was a reporter who asked Chuck Yeager, have you ever seen a UFO? To which General Yeager replied, no, ma'am, because I don't drink, but I fly. there's the moment to be human. And finally, you know, I have to say, you know, for myself, a science journalist is only as good as a scientist's patience is long. And I really appreciate the time I've been given by scientists. In some ways, the only thing harder on you than when we get it wrong is when we work really, really hard to get it right and we take hours of your time. I deeply appreciate this, and I can tell you that I've personally put it to the test, having had a Nobel laureate in physics explain Hooke's law to me. So again, I cannot thank you enough for the time that you give to all of us.
We have time for questions.
Yes.
This happened to me a couple of weeks ago, so we had some paper which was a lot of work without a press release. The journalist read it. Eastern Europe somewhere. And then the title of the next day ends up in Eastern Europe, which completely, you know, which sort of took the press release and reported it in some way, changed the orders of sentences, completely changes the stuff attributed to me and publishers. They left off to me, never left the responses they saw, whatever.
That, wow, that's bad.
No, actually,
actually, local papers will, you know, they have very small staff, so they've been known to rewrite press releases.
Exactly, that doesn't work on that one probably.
Yeah. But you can say that they don't do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they didn't say they quoted it, they said, according to
the scientists, exactly.
That's what happens.
But your name is in the...
They didn't attribute it to me as a quote. They said, they said, according to the scientists, and then they tried to rephrase my actual quote, but they were wrong.
Well, right?
There's
two problems. One is it's sort of the nature of the beast, because this goes a lot to the news stories, where you get the university press release, you've got an hour to try to make it into a comprehensible story. I have to say, work very closely with the university press departments, because I've seen some beautifully written releases out of university press offices. So sometimes the problem can start with the release. But then it's heartbreaking because somebody in the press office tried really, really hard to get it right and the reporter got it wrong. And again, sometimes that's just a timing thing. And the best thing to do is to just write a very polite, short letter to the editor, because even letters to the editor are edited. So if you can keep it to under a paragraph, saying, thank you very much, I was pleased to see that you did a story on me. However, I would just like to correct for the record this one thing.
That's the best way to do that.
Yeah.
This is more of an intellectual question. Do you guys have any idea of when? Has anybody looked at the history of science journalism? When did we start requiring, in a way, journalism? When I think of Darwin's Origin of Species, 150 years ago, that was a piece of primary research literature, really, but meant for and written for, intelligent but public, lay public otherwise. We clearly don't do that anymore. I mean, the primary literature is no longer available in general to the populace. It's not even available across disciplines, in some cases within sub-disciplines. So I'm just curious as to when, does anybody have any idea when all that came about? I mean, is that just...
I know that there are some histories out there. I think if you go to like the National Association of Science Writers, they have some historical documents and stuff. Some of the science writing programs might know a little bit about that. Initially science journalism was just journalism. People just reported about science in the newspapers. Exactly. When it evolved into a separate thing, I'm not sure. Maybe so, definitely in the 20th century. I'm just not sure when.
I actually have a comment. There's a really much worse paradox in the 21st century with respect to journalism than the antique values built into that practice, which sort of impose practices that might have been justified by tight deadlines and newsboys on corners, and hope that'll disappear like the dinosaurs did. But in the 21st century, scientists have become a little bit more self-aware. And narrative plays a very unusual role. If you read articles that are more than 20 years old, they're actually better as fiction than as science. And I'm talking about scientific literature. One almost exception is the Double Helix article, which still reads well except for the last couple of sentences. And they're involved with establishing priority over Rosie Franklin and over Linus Pauling, who had a triple helix.
Right, right, yeah.
So if you read the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, for example, the famous one that has now launched whole sections of quantum information, re-justified certain quantum mechanics. They never invoke any of the second principle that is used by Bell and everyone who succeeds him to get the result. And the state they write down doesn't violate Bell's inequality. So everything that's thought to be known about the EPR paper and the work that came from it is untrue.
He, Einstein explicitly mentions interactions that are no longer occurring, not space-like separation, because he knew the theory he was talking about was not relativistically invariant. So he would never have made the mistake that Bell actually turned into a tremendous advantage. When the particles separate, so they can't communicate unless they talk faster than the speed of light, then you know something. Einstein didn't use that argument. No, of course, he didn't have Bell's inequality. But the story that science, the story that science is progressive, I can see David doesn't agree with me. That science is progressive and everything that we know is better than what we knew before is incorrect. What actually happens is that what we knew before, well, it's our business to prove what's wrong.
What some of us knew.
No, but our business is to prove it wrong.
Well, there's something that I disagree with your argument about that Watson paper. There were three articles in the same issue of Nature.
Right. Yeah.
They talk about different things. Yeah. The Franklin paper is exactly near the Watson paper. If you read the paper, it says different things. It says something about the geometry. It says nothing about the possibility,
right,
about the pairing and about the possibility of
explaining
anything to do with genetic information. So I think that it's not a matter of priority. They were just dealing with different problems. So.
I quoted
Watson and Crick actually got that model because they were thinking about what the system was actually doing, what it was supposed to do. And the structural biologists did not approach the functionality of it. So,
no, but I agree. I think that paper actually survives much better than some of the No, I agree with you.
That one looks every, but I'm just that it's not a priority claim there. They were just dealing with different problems.
No, I'm saying look very carefully at the last couple of sentences.
This might not be the right thing for deciding how much credit.
Yeah,
yes,
you're right.
I have a question for the journalists. I mean, we've got the LHC coming up this year. It's the big non-written up story yet. So is this going to be completely ignored unless Higgs is discovered? Or how are they going to write up the...
It hasn't been. It's actually been covered a lot.
Quite a bit,
But
the results going to be covered systematically, sort of like, aren't we lucky to have this coming out now, and this is what's happening?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I agree with David. I think the LHC community has done a fantastic pre-sale job, and that now, but because they've done a fantastic pre-sale job in terms of setting up the LHC, now they have to report on the results. I'm serious. I mean, you have to do the follow-up.
This is unprecedented, actually. I've really never done this in the past, and it's something a lot of us were urging after the SEC collapse would be done in time. And so that was part of the realization that, you know, we better do this well, because otherwise these discoveries will be made and nobody will pay attention. So that's part of, you know, sort of organized big science policy, which is very important, is to prepare the public media for things which are hard to explain, but you have to be prepared. The astronomers and cosmologists have been superb at this. Long before COVID and WMAP, they already were preparing, often with exaggerated statements, but, you know, discovering the secret of the universe for the 20th time, but every time it got solid and solid.
Yes,
so
that's, right.
That's really important to do. But we were also benefited, you know, the reason this is happening is because we delayed, so we got nothing to turn. It should have been, it was 3 years ago or so, and so this period.
I will say, you should expect one thing, you know, brace yourselves, that if all you find is a Higgs and we don't find it and it's not quite right away, there might
be
a tiny bit of backlash. So you can risk that.
Well,
so
it's just the nature of race. To some extent, it would be just fine. I mean, this is a severe crisis for the field, and it would be worthy of note. That did happen in a famous article in the New York Times, which did really well.
George Johnson wrote it.
George Johnson.
You know, 20 years, supersymmetry. Thousands of physicists work very hard and do not find evidence for supersymmetry. Yeah, and they're ruling out parameter space. But there's another thing, but that's actually, that feeds into exactly what I wanted to say, which is that, and also back to what you said earlier, the way that science works is a different rhythm and a different mode than the way journalism works. And science does not progress through a series of individual point-like events that make the difference and nothing happens in between. So, some events are better than others. But so our blog got involved in a controversy about this, which illustrates how a lot of, how at least some science journalists, despite being in it, don't get how science actually works, because they get a series of press releases. And John Conway, an experimentalist on our blog, was trying to explain how it is, what it is like to really be an experimental particle physicist. So he wrote a story about how they found a little excess in their data, and it was only 2 sigma. It was not statistically significant, but you know, in the process of, that's right, he's looking for the Higgs, he found a 2 sigma excess. Now as a scientist, I know, well yeah, you find 2 sigma excesses all the time and no press releases are coming. But because the journalists were used to only seeing results when they were a result, and John was trying to give some of the inside scoop, in, you know, magazines from New Scientist, The Economist, all over the place, it's like physicists discover Higgs and it's announced on a blog. And this is just completely missing the point. And so I think that, it's certainly not his fault. He was trying to do exactly the right thing. But I think that with the LHC, there's going to be even more of an issue of when do we have discovery or evidence for or consistency with, because the pressure is so big to get an important result. And the experimentalists want to get good results, the theorists want to get credit for it, who gets to look at the data. You know, it's going to be a tightrope that I'm glad that I'm not involved in walking.
Very interesting, turned out to be wrong. A lot of them, you know, 12 different, lots of science or lots of experiments, discovery, lack of discovery, now the consensus is going to be very recent. But we didn't, it wasn't pre-hypothesis on it. The difference is what we like seeing is, you know, it's as if Kobe, you know, which there was already a for, but W might be more by that time, had actually failed. You know, it didn't work out.
Yeah.
Or Kobe seen nothing. And that would have been a crisis as well, but a much harder one to explain. So
yeah.
Luckily, that buildup that went in astrophysics, partly because of NASA, and partly because of people like David Shannon, who were out there, worked very well. So hopefully we'll be in the same position.
Part of the problem is, and this goes with general misunderstanding of the scientific method among the public, which is the notion that failure is not necessarily a bad thing. Exactly. And so you have this general kind of misunderstanding of how science works. And it's frustrating because as science journalists, we know how it works, but we've got to get something in print by 5 p.m. And, you know, so even though we know, you know, and again, it happens in biology all the time, that, you know, you see these cancer-cured headlines, even though we know that it means that somebody had some rat that didn't die, and maybe, you know, 10 years down the line, they'll really have confirmation. But, you know, it is a voracious cycle, and a lot of journalists feel the frustration of it, actually, because you're constantly, as Jennifer said, you're feeding the beast, and, you know, sometimes you're feeding it junk food. Yeah.
I guess that's it. We've gone a little bit over, but thanks, everybody, for coming. This was a great discussion. So.